It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we continue our series on literacy in Wisconsin and find out how one county's jail inmates are getting an education from a local literacy project.
First, improv groups like Second City in Chicago make us laugh, but our next guest says they can also help us learn to be better communicators. She runs classes and seminars to help businesses improve communication and leadership using the basic building blocks of improv comedy, and she's with us now to share her philosophies.
Lisa Carlson is a speaker and trainer who uses improv to help people communicate better. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, hi, Rob. Hi, Veronica. It's my pleasure.
Well, Lisa, improv, it seems like it's all over the place in recent years, but for people who haven't encountered it, give us a brief rundown. How does it work?
Sure. So most people think of improv as comedy first, and basically it's a game that might be set up, and everything is off the cuff, off the brain. There's no preparing, really, except for the practice that you do as an improv actor. But everything's made up on the spot.
And so when you say the principles of improv can help us communicate better, help us be heard, what kinds of skills and principles are you talking about?
Sure. So improv really doesn't have any rules except for the fact that we say that it doesn't have any rules, meaning that whatever is said is golden. If you say that the purple sky is going to shoot out rainbows and yellow canaries, absolutely an improv actor is going to accept that and move on with that and actually heighten the scene. So because we are trained to accept what's being said or done, we can help that show keep the flow going, which is some of the principles that I teach other people. Because when I went to Second City to train, I really thought I'd be funnier or wittier, which maybe happened, I don't know, but it actually changed the way I approached life. And once I used that daily, I was able to see how people communicate and also how to improve communication.
Well, let's talk about some of the listening and reacting styles that we see in improv. Let's talk about the principles that we could then apply outside of the improv world.
Sure. So number one is that you say yes, that you're agreeing with what's being said. Not that you agree with it, but that you agree that you're hearing it. That's number one. We say yes. The second part is yes and. So I've heard you, and I'm going to validate you. I'm going to either add to that, or I'm going to make sure that you know that I've heard you. The other part is that we support one another. We always support one another. And actually, the fourth part is, which is the last one that I can tell you, is we take risks. We don't mind failing. And that kind of comes into the fact of judging, prejudging. We're always, what if I don't say something? Or what if I do say something? That's where the risk-taking comes.
I've heard about the yes and aspect of that before. What improves when, you know, your colleague says something and instead of going, yeah, but that's not going to work, you go, you know, yes and? What changes in that dynamic?
Sure. So if you've been in any environment where you know that the dynamics of people are always different and you walk into a meeting or any kind of event where you know there might be some resistance, we should really put on that festival. Yeah, but we've done that before. We've tried that already. And so what happens is you break down the communication of the person who's sharing it, because we all just want to be heard. It's the value of being heard. Of course, you've got an employee who's always constantly being told no, they're never going to bring their ideas to the table. So innovation, collaboration, and communication breaks down. So an example I use is if you're a busy, busy boss and you have an employee that comes bouncing into your office and says, hey, I've got this idea I'd like to share with you, instead of saying, I'm so busy, we have deadlines, sometimes saying, I would love to hear your idea, which is yes, and can you make an appointment with me for coffee next week? That's the and.
We're talking to Lisa Carlson. She's a Wisconsin-based speaker and trainer. She's telling us how we can use the principles of improv to help us communicate better, not on the stage, in our daily lives, at work, say. So at work, Sometimes we'll hear an idea and think that's such a bad idea that I don't want to give it the yes and improv. We should just sell all our corporate holdings and invest in a rocket to Saturn. How can you really apply improv to anything that a colleague says?
Yes, Rob, you can. And it takes training to not react in the whole, like, what are you talking about there? So you say, yes, Andy, rocket scientists are great. And I think that might be something we could put on the table. Let's talk about the issue at hand. So at least they understand that maybe they've kind of got off the deep end and it's a different conversation. But there's absolutely, it's just respect, really. It's just, how do we, because people get excited. It doesn't have to be the naysayers. It's just like, oh my gosh, and then we could do this and this and this and this. And it does take some training to say, yes, I love all of your ideas, and we have one that we're going to flesh out until we get to the next one. That's one way that you could probably communicate that. Again, it goes back to helping people feel validated, feeling like they've been heard. And sometimes we bring up ideas that we don't really care if they're done our way. We just want to feel value in the fact that we were able to respond.
And you teach these improv-style skills to business people, to professional people. Are there any particular exercises that you do to get them to embrace these?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're having fun all day long. And I actually have different games depending on which kind of group I'm tailoring it to. Maybe they want to do more collaboration, or maybe they want more communication. So I really tailor some of the games that you've probably seen if you've ever watched Whose Line Is It Anyway or something like that. What I do is I take them and I apply to why we're using them so they understand the game a little bit better. And they can take them and use them if they've got a culture that does that in their own businesses. What happens is that after a whole half day or an hour or two of play, people start to ask, well, I've got this employee and blah, 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 and they actually try to apply it. So it's really great because they both get the fun and that looseness understanding, and then they also get to ask questions on how to talk it out, like the rocket scientist.
And Lisa, you mentioned that part of the point here is that using this yes and improv approach will help overcome that sort of instinctive resistance people have to a new idea, maybe an out-of-the-box mm-hmm. idea. Do you encounter that resistance as you're trying to teach it to people? People say, Lisa, no and no.
Yes, I do. I have this one game. It's called One Word at a Time. And I get three volunteers up, and we have to create a sentence one word at a time. And usually it's like about hamburgers or Bloody Marys or happy hour. And so what will happen is the best part is that people get to see it. They're predetermining where the sentence should go. Or they're like, what are you talking about? So it's a great exercise to show them the resistance that they're using in everyday life.
Lisa, I understand that both of your parents were deaf. Your husband is as well. Did that help you learn to communicate and how you approach it?
Yes, both my parents and my husband are deaf, and it's like I'm collecting deaf people. I've been a great observer of body language and how people respond to spoken language. So I can read somebody's face and see, well, I didn't understand what you're saying. And it's another thing that I also teach just briefly about, because when you are paying attention or listening, you can see those cues in other people. So, for example, the one story I tell about my husband and I went into a furniture store. He goes one way, I go the other, and we meet in the middle, and I sign to him, hey, did you see anything? And behind him, I notice that there's this guy, this sales guy, like really kind of red-faced and a little agitated. Well, it turns out that he, as soon as I signed, the furniture salesman goes, oh, that's why. He had assumed my husband had ignored him the whole time, and he was probably saying, hello, hello, can I help you? Is there something you need? And so just cueing into people that just because someone doesn't hear you doesn't mean that they're ignoring you.
As we wrap up, Lisa, can you leave us with one piece of advice that our listeners can try to be a better listener?
Absolutely. I would say that if you can approach things with an open mind, don't prejudge what you're going to say or prejudge what someone else is going to say, you'll be able to use the yes part very quickly.
Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much. I'm wishing you a wonderful day.
Thanks so much. That's Lisa Carlson. She's a speaker and trainer based in Northeast Wisconsin who uses the principles of improv to help people communicate better. With us, she joins us to tell us how improv humor can help us communicate.
Coming up, we continue our series on literacy in Wisconsin with a look at a project that's helping jail inmates in Ozaukee County get their GED. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the unexpected death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia is creating a lot of political and legal questions. We'll talk to a political scientist and presidential scholar about what happens next.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. And all this week, our look at literacy in Wisconsin. Augie Flum is a welder and an accomplished artist making beautiful metal flowers for display in yards and gardens. He excelled in math and art in school, but struggled with reading his whole life. He's been working to improve his reading with the help of his tutor, Chuck.
My name's Augie Flum. I'm a welder. I've been a welder for probably about 40 years now. I had struggled in blueprint reading, and that was one of the deals when I started my job that I would get back because I got the reading disability. Basically come across, I made some mistakes. The mistakes I made, they kind of brought me in the office and made me feel like an illiterate dummy that can't read blueprints, which it shouldn't have been brought across that way, but that's the way it was kind of brought across.
Chuck Bornhoft. 4 years I've been with Literacy Volunteers Marquette County. I had retired, so I was kind of looking for ways that I can help out and do things, and one of my employees always enjoyed his time volunteering with literacy. So as I was kind of looking around, what do I want to do and what might be something I'd enjoy, literacy came to mind, and I made a call and talked with our president, and it's been kind of one right after another ever since. Augie started with a different tutor in our organization, and he and I have been working since September.
Right now we're working on a blueprint reading book to learn, get me more advanced in the blueprints. So I like reading a lot of papers and stuff like that, which is kind of simple, but it gets me to learn the words and lets me to go further.
I've learned a lot about reading blueprints, and Augie's taught me a bunch on some of the measurements and the other terms as well, so it really is a collaborative effort.
I make stainless flowers. I make all different kinds of flowers, and the leaves are stainless steel, and then I weld them to rebar. I built one at work for my wife, and everybody at work really thought they were neat, so everybody at work wanted one. And then I thought, well, I might have something here. So then I just started building them and started a business.
Augie's, his artwork is truly magnificent. I have one of his cone flowers in my front yard, and I get comments on it all the time.
It's basically my art background and stuff, and I really enjoy it.
It's so neat meeting other people, and you're meeting people who may have had a different educational background or a little different career background, and that's what I look at the literacy is we're trying just to help people and to complement their lives and to be more comfortable in what they do, and I find that extremely rewarding. It's just been a great thing for me.
The teachers are very, very good, very understanding, very helpful. It's really nice. It makes me feel good.
Augie Flum is a welder and metal artist. He and his tutor Chuck shared their stories as part of this week's look at literacy in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
We continue our look at literacy in the state with an effort to boost literacy for jail inmates in one Wisconsin county. Patty Puccinelli joins us now. She's lead teacher for the Ozaukee County Jail Literacy Program. Patty, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Patty, tell us, what's the mission of this jail literacy program?
The mission of the program is to provide educational opportunities for students, for inmates who are incarcerated at the Ozaukee County Jail. Our target group is adults who do not have a high school diploma, so we're a GED program. We hope that once the students leave the program and leave the jail with this credential, or at least some of the credential, they can go out and they are better employable. They can better support their families. They may go on to post-secondary school like MATC or UWM. But importantly, the jail population as a whole has a 75% recidivism rate, and our students have a 44% recidivism rate. So all those steps are geared towards, in the end, hoping that these students will become more productive.
So what kind of literacy education is involved in helping these jail inmates get their GED?
Well, there are four GED tests, reading and language arts, social studies, math and science. And in 2014, the test became much more rigorous than it had been before. So the students are required to learn their material well and then take a test in each one of the four subjects that is sanctioned by the state.
And you mentioned that these are obviously jail inmates who don't have a high school diploma. That's why they would need the GED. What's the range of educational levels that they're at when you start working with them?
We get a very wide spectrum. Sometimes the students come to us with a third or fourth grade reading and math level. Sometimes, especially the ones who were not all that far from high school, they may have an 11th or 12th grade. It's so varied.
We're talking to Patty Puccinelli. She's lead teacher for the Ozaukee County Jail Literacy Program as part of our week-long look at literacy efforts in Wisconsin. So how do you coordinate this with the staff at the jail? How does this work, I guess, logistically?
Well, there's a lot of rules, and we have requirements that we have a classroom inside the jail. So the students that are part of the program, we're only allowed to have 10 at a time. So we inform the various controls, the places where the students live, who's supposed to be coming that day, and they are let out of their tiers and dorms and brought to the classroom. And they sit in the classroom in their orange clothes and study their material.
What kind of reaction do you get from the inmates you work with?
Oh, the students are very, very appreciative. They are sometimes express surprise that somebody would even bother with helping them. And then when they accomplish a test and pass it, and then more and more accomplish more and more, they're thrilled. It's a high-five moment when a student passes something.
With that.
And we also see that their self-esteem increases. Sometimes their experience in school hasn't been good, so they learn that they can do this.
How many inmates have graduated from the program so far?
Well, as of last Thursday, we have 292. A student passed his social studies test, which was the fourth test for him, and so he has earned his GED credential. He is staying with us because he's going to go on and try to earn his HSED, which will involve passing the civics state test, the health state test, and then completing his employability. So he's only going to be with us a couple of more weeks, and we're really going to try and help him. He is a good studier, so, you know, this is possible.
So that number you said, almost 300 now, that's people who have actually completed all the four tests you mentioned.
Yes, yeah, and they have their GED credential. So now with that, they can walk into a college and enroll, or they can walk into a job, and when someone says, do you have a credential from high school, they can say, yes, I have a GED.
And you mentioned the change in recidivism rates for people who had been through your program. That's pretty big. Why does this make such a difference in a jail inmate who wants to not end up back in jail or end up in prison?
I think it's because they can go out and be successful, have a job that isn't just minimum wage or just above, or they can go to a program and earn a certificate in something and do a job that they like. I also think that if they're committed to their employability and committed to succeeding, they also are willing or want to continue to support their families.
And speaking of support, where does the support, the funding, that kind of thing come from for this jail literacy program in Ozaukee County?
Well, the county does not provide funding for us at all. We get grants. One grant is from the Adult Education and Family Literacy. We get another grant from the United Way Northern Ozaukee. We also have community organizations like the Rotary and Lions Club and Women's Club who donate to us. We have also some donations from local businesses, from churches and individuals. So it's as my boss says, the funding is a challenge, but it really does produce tangible results.
Well, Patty, thanks for telling us about the program, and good luck.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That's Patty Puccinelli, lead teacher for the Ozaukee County Jail Literacy Program.
Coming up, we'll talk to an expert about the political and legal fallout of the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk about what bills and measures could be approved by the legislature as lawmakers begin to end the session.
First, the unexpected death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia will have consequences in Congress, in the presidential election, and on legal cases being considered by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the Thurman Rule doesn't need to begin in June. It can begin now. The Thurman Rule is an unwritten rule named after the late Republican Senator Strom Thurmond, who said no lifetime judicial appointments should be made in the last 6 months or so of a lame duck presidency. That six-month period begins in June for President Obama.
Barbara Perry joins us now to talk about the political and legal fallout of Justice Scalia's death. She's a professor of political science and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, great to be with you, Rob.
Well, this came out just this afternoon, a news conference today after a meeting of the U.S. and an association of Southeast Asian nations. President Obama said his piece about that and then, of course, was asked by a reporter about this Supreme Court situation. He offered condolences to Justice Scalia's family and addressed the fact that he would be nominating someone to replace him. Here's a listen.
The Constitution is pretty clear about what is supposed to happen now. When there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court, the President of the United States is to nominate someone. The Senate is to consider that nomination and either they disapprove of that nominee or that nominee is elevated to the Supreme Court. Historically, this has not been viewed as a question.
Well, here we are now, Barbara. People are viewing this as a question. Republican people, for the most part, saying, no, hold on, let the next president decide. Is this uncharted territory in some ways?
It is, Rob, in this sense that, first of all, we've had very few justices die in office in the modern era, except for Chief Justice Rehnquist, everyone remembers, from Wisconsin, just Chief Justice Rehnquist. Of course, passed away in 2005, but that was not unexpected, and it was not a presidential election year. So you have to go all the way back to 1953 to find the previous, then also a chief justice, dying in office. So most justices, first of all, live very long lives, and they tend to, if they come into ill health, they typically will step down. So in that sense, we are in uncharted waters. We are not in uncharted waters for presidents nominating successfully members of the U.S. Supreme Court in the final years of their terms. And I've just been doing some research on that over the last day or two, as you can imagine. There have been 112 successful nominations to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the fact of the matter is 21 justices took their seats in the last year of a presidency, and that means that 16 presidents have filled a seat in the final year, including several who had lost for re-election or had decided to step out of the presidency. So partly we're in uncharted waters of in the modern era, as I say, but historically speaking, over the whole sweep of American history, not so much. And presidents, including Andrew Jackson, literally as he left office on the final full day, nominated two people to the U.S. Supreme Court, one successfully so.
Barbara, correct me if I'm wrong. It seems like the Supreme Court nominations starting, I'm going to say, in the 1980s or so, got more contentious, where it was going to be harder for an outgoing president to sneak something through like this. Am I right? Do we get more tied up over these nominations than we used to?
Well, I like your question in two ways. First of all, yes, you're absolutely right to point to the 1980s as a turning point with Robert Bork. And it wasn't that so much that his nomination came in a presidential election year. In fact, it came in 1987 when Justice Powell stepped down, retired from the court in the summer of 1987. The problem there, and the reason that became so controversial, was that Justice Powell at the time was viewed as the swing voter on the court, that in cases that people really cared about, abortion, affirmative action, and others, that there were tended to be four conservatives, four liberals, and oftentimes Justice Powell would swing between those two factions and provide the fifth vote, sometimes conservative, sometimes liberal. So what I call that as happening is swing seat politics takes over rather than presidential election politics. And we know, people who know their history know, that Robert Bork was not confirmed. And in that case, a Republican president nominating with the Democrats, yes, giving an up or down vote, but led by Ted Kennedy in particular, really, really coming out against Bork because he was well known as a staunch conservative going into that swing seat. So that is a turning point both for modern media, the modern presidency, and the way these things are reported, and the role of interest groups, we should add as well. You add to that mix, that stew, social media, and you have a volatile mixture in coming in a presidential election year as we are. I would take issue, though, with the word sneak. I don't think any president can sneak through anyone these days, and there's nothing sneaky about it. The president, by the role that he swears to play in upholding the Constitution, has the role to fill vacancies on the U.S. Supreme Court and all the lower federal courts. It is then up to the president to pass that on to the Senate, for the Senate to give it an up or down vote. So I think really where we are here now is whether the Republicans in the Senate will stall to the point where they just simply won't allow an up or down vote.
Talking to Barbara Perry about Supreme Court politics. And yeah, let's get to the Republicans in the Senate. Mitch McConnell saying the president shouldn't appoint anyone. Leave that for your successor. Other Republicans saying stall, stall, stall. Others saying, hey, if we do start reviewing, Ted Cruz here, I'm going to filibuster. So what do you make of all that, of the Republican opposition? How do you think it's all going to settle out, and what's going to happen?
Well, that's what makes it so interesting for those of us who follow this from a historical perspective, and that is that, again, this is not unprecedented on whichever way it goes. It's not unprecedented, of course, for the Senate to, first of all, block a vote that is not to filibuster and not to have a vote. So that happened in 1968 with Lyndon Johnson. He had got the word from then the Chief Justice Earl Warren, who himself was a punching bag for the right in those days. Impeach Earl Warren signs sprouted up around the country. So when he announced to Johnson that he wanted to step aside, Johnson, who was in the summer prior to his leaving office in 1969, nominated, promoted from associate to chief, Abe Fortas. And with Strom Thurmond leading the way, with conservative Republicans as well as conservative Democrats from the South in those days bottled up in a filibuster, much as Ted Cruz is saying he would do. So there's precedent for that. There's precedent, as we mentioned, with Robert Bork for, in that case, the Democrats not to allow a nominee to go through of the president. But then on the other hand, there are actually many, many more examples of, as I say, these presidents over history, including George Washington, nominating justices of the Supreme Court, filling vacancies in the final year of their office throughout those 12 months, before the end of the term, and the Senate going ahead and approving them.
I want to turn to the court itself and the meaning of a 4-4 tie on many contentious issues. There are cases that are on their way to the Supreme Court in process one way or another. Admitting privileges for abortion doctors. There's Wisconsin laws, Texas laws, different rulings in lower courts on their way up there. What does a 4-4 tie in a vote from the Supreme Court mean when a case gets sent to them?
This is why this is such a crucial seat, Rob, as you're pointing out. First of all, 4-4 ties allow for the lower court decision to remain in place. So in the case of the Fifth Circuit's decision in the abortion case, which is, I understand, similar to one you have coming out of the Seventh Circuit in Wisconsin, but as I also understand, those two circuit courts split in how they voted on a similar law, the Fifth Circuit upheld that law, making it more difficult for women seeking abortions in Texas. That case is before the court. A 4-4 tie would therefore allow that Fifth Circuit ruling to stand, that is upholding this law that would make it more difficult for women seeking abortions, but it does not set a precedent across the country. Therefore, the Seventh Circuit decision would stand, which, as I understand, ruled oppositely for a similar law. And this is why this is such a crucial seat. Not only is the court on these kinds of issues that are highly charged and people care about and they're very emotional, can lead to these 4-4 ties between four conservatives and four liberals. But if this period stretches on beyond the election year, so let's say for the sake of argument that Mitch McConnell says no up or down vote at all, or that comes to a vote and there's no replacement for Scalia because there's not a person who's approved to come after him, it can't be the very first day that the new president comes on board, January 20th, 2017, that president would nominate someone and boom, that day the person would be approved. So we'd have another period of some months before that seat would be filled. We could go close to a year with that seat remaining vacant on the bench.
We hear a lot about dysfunction in Congress. I mean, is this another dysfunctional element of American government then if we've got this tied court with no tiebreaker?
I would say when people focus a little bit, perhaps too much, on the dysfunction, that this is a dysfunction that's built into the system. So that when the founding fathers gathered in Philadelphia in 1787, they actually did talk about, once they set out the three branches of government in our Constitution, they talked about having the executive have full power to nominate a member of the Supreme Court, and they decided that was too what they called monarchical. Then they said, well, what about the legislature itself? Just no president involved, just have one or two of the houses of Congress. And they said, oh, too much what they called intrigue in the Congress, and those people would have no knowledge of what they called the peculiar qualities needed to be on the Supreme Court. So that's how we ended up with this compromise, with the president nominating and with the advice and consent of the Senate approving and appointing to the Supreme Court. So, yes, we do have periods like this where we're hyper-partisan, but that goes all the way back to the beginning of our nation with the Federalists and the Jeffersonians fighting it out, guess what, over Supreme Court appointments.
We're talking right now, excuse me, with political scientist Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia, looking at the political and legal fallout of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's death.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you think Republicans in the Senate should give President Obama's nominee a hearing? Do you think voters should have a say in choosing the next Supreme Court justice? Call with your thoughts right now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion about the legal and political fallout of the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia with Barbara Perry, a political scientist and presidential scholar from the University of Virginia.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the conflict over this appointment process? Should President Obama make this appointment, as he says he will? If so, how should the Senate react? Should they ignore him, stall, as some Republicans have said, or give serious consideration to his nominee? Should it all wait for the next president instead? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers. We've got Bob on the line in Milwaukee. Bob, hi.
Hi. I have a question about, you talk about historically that lame duck presidents have successfully nominated Supreme Court justices, and I was just wondering how long it has been since there was a successful nomination that was then confirmed by the Senate.
Bob, thanks for that call. And Barbara, part of this answer, I guess, depends on what we mean by lame duck president. And I've seen people argue over what that means.
Yes, good point. The dictionary definition, and I'll stick to that, is a president is viewed as a lame duck if his successor has been elected. So in other words, a president would be viewed technically, although this is not a legal term, obviously, but technically as a definitional term from the November election to the inauguration. We should also point out that that time period was much longer prior to 1937, when by constitutional amendment the time in which the president was inaugurated was changed to January from March in order to cut down on the length of time that a president would be a lame duck. So actually, having gone back in and to answer Bob's question, I come up with the number of lame ducks as actually being five. Again, genuine lame ducks who had already been, their successor had already been elected. And in fact, some of these appointments took place by, for example, Harrison, Benjamin Harrison, back in the 1880s, early 90s. He had been defeated. He had actually been defeated. So some of them were leaving office. Jackson made this as appointment, as I say, on the last day he was in office, but he had served his two terms and he was moving on out. But there actually are examples of three defeated presidents and one who had stepped aside from the election, so four total, who were genuine lame ducks. They had a successor who had been elected. They had been repudiated by the people, and yet they made successful nominations to the Supreme Court.
And with that looser definition, I guess, of a president in their last year, they know they're not coming back. More, I assume, than that?
Oh, yes, way more. By my count, I've got 21 justices taking their seats from presidents in the last year prior to an election. That's 16 presidents total, again, by my count, have filled a seat in their final year. And six of those presidents fall into the same category as Barack Obama. That is, they are in their final year and they are not running for re-election.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Ben on the line in Burlington. Ben, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest could comment, and I think she briefly touched on this, with respect to President Reagan and his last year. I've seen some memes floating around about how President Obama should wait to nominate, though the same argument was made when President Reagan was in his final year of the presidency. Is there any truth to that, or is this just useless memes?
Ben, thanks for that call. Interesting, good point to bring up for clarification. Barbara, would that be the that nomination that was originally Bork and then different Ginsburg, I think, and then ended up being Anthony Kennedy, so it kind of bled over into his last year?
That's exactly right, Rob. So actually, as I mentioned earlier, that seat opened up, that Powell seat opened up in 1987, in June, when the court typically ends its term at the end of June or early July of that year in 87, Powell announced his retirement. And we should point something else out that I think is particularly fascinating. Powell announced his retirement and stepped down at the end of the court's term, leaving that seat open. And so it did remain open on into what became Reagan's last year in 1988, end of his two terms, when he finally got to as they used to call themselves, old number three. Old number three was Anthony Kennedy, who then comes on the court in early 1988. But just just as O'Connor, when she retired in 2005, she actually wrote into her retirement letter that she was retiring but would step down only when her successor had been confirmed. So that seat then did not remain open, though that was a controversial nomination, as we remember. Well, certainly first with Roberts, not controversial, but then when Rehnquist passed on, he was promoted up to chief, and then Harriet Myers came along. That was controversial. She stepped aside, and then Alito's appointment was rather controversial as well. So all during those months and back into 1987-88 period, you could end up with an open seat. In 87 and 88, we had an open seat. Powell had been the swing justice, and there were cases that were churning through the system. The court was voting on them and coming to, on occasion, to 4-4 ties.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ben, as we talk to Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia talking about Supreme Court politics. We'll go next to Jimmy on the line in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Afternoon. I guess I see some political strategy for the election in this, too, because prime for both sides, because you want to get your voters out to the poll, and what better way to get them motivated than to have a Supreme Court justice opening, especially on the Republican side, that, you know, with everything going on in their race, they may not be very excited about going to the polls this November. And I guess my fear is, could there be a tit for tat? Let's say the Santa Cruz Democrat and Republican in the White House, and, for example, Ginsburg leaves. Couldn't the Democratic Senate do the same thing to the Republican president? I will take the comments off the air.
Jimmy, thanks a lot. And Barbara, Jimmy brings up a lot there. There's a complicated political calculus, the presidential race, but not only that, a lot of races for Senate where, say, maybe Republican might want to appeal to moderate voters in the general election, and so they want to look like they're getting things done, but they don't want a primary challenge on the conservative side, so they don't want to approve an Obama nominee.
Well, this threw a wrench into the works, didn't it? But this is what we political scientists who study the presidency and the courts live for, is that it's absolutely fascinating and terribly complex with a lot of moving parts. So Jimmy's absolutely correct that there's a lot of political strategizing that's going on, attempts to do the thing that's going to help one's party, but not overplay one's hand. And Jimmy's last point, what goes around comes around. And so those who might complain about what would happen with a Republican majority in this Senate and what they would do to a Democrat nominee must think back to the Bork era and what the Democratic majority did to Robert Bork. And so, yes, it could come around that if that seat remains open and you have a switch of parties between the White House and the Senate, that there could just be another situation where that seat remains open, and that's never good. And as someone who really cares about the court and who worked at the court for a year in the mid-90s, it's never good for the court to be brought in to the muck and mire of everyday politics. Usually they tend to remain above that, and that's a good thing for them. They don't have the power of the purse or the power of the sword, as Hamilton said. And so I like to see them remain above that if they can, and that's what the founders had intended.
Was there any hope, you think, that the White House and Congress will sort of rise above and say, hey, let's agree on a moderate, well-respected legal mind that we could put on there, set aside our partisan differences, and get a good Supreme Court justice that may or may not back our side or your side?
I think given the split, the pointed partisan split, the sharp elbows that we have flying right now, that approach may not work, although someone like Judge Sri Srinivasan from the D.C. Circuit is brought up quite a lot, and I think would be an excellent appointee because he clerked for Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, a Reagan appointee on the Fourth Circuit and a moderate conservative, and clerked at the Supreme Court for Sandra Day O'Connor, a Reagan appointee, moderate conservative. Here's another possibility, though. Pick an older statesman or woman, perhaps a former senator, going for the Senate vote itself, and for somebody who has a law degree but perhaps is not written in a judicial way, but who won't be on the court forever. Maybe that's the kind of interesting, different compromise that could square the circle here.
That's how they used to pick party secretaries in 1980s Soviet Union, somebody who won't be around long enough so we can compromise.
And we remember those Soviet leaders who were dropping like flies.
I wanted to ask you, Barbara, I understand you had met, you knew Justice Scalia personally. Can you talk about him just briefly as we wrap up, outside of his role as a Supreme Court Justice?
I sure did. I was honored to know him for almost all of his 30 years on the bench. I interviewed him as a graduate student, which I thought was amazing that he would open up his chambers to me as I did my dissertation on Catholic justices. I didn't necessarily always agree with him, but there are a few justices I do always agree with, but I admired his keen legal mind, and he had a delightful sense of humor that I will miss when I go to oral arguments, and I would occasionally even have lunch with him in his chambers, and again, I would sometimes think that what he was saying was pretty outrageous, but I always appreciated what he had to say, the keen intellect and the lovely sense of humor, and generally the care that he had for many people that I saw firsthand, including myself.
Barbara, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're so welcome, Rob. Thank you.
That's Barbara Perry, professor of political science at the University of Virginia, with us to talk about the latest in Supreme Court politics.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then the legislative session will wrap up at the end of this week in the Assembly. We'll take a look at what bills could be passed by lawmakers. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.